Hey everyone, it's me, Arthur Cade, the one and only Pam Anderson. I had no idea how much of a supporter you were of Israel until tonight, and you're being honored by this incredible organization. Talk to me all about this honor.
Well, I'm very excited. You know, I've been to Israel a few times, and I love Israel. They're one of the most vegetarian nations. They're spreading kindness and compassion around the world, and I just think that they're a great example. And, you know, on the memory of the Holocaust, I think this is a wonderful time to come and pay tribute to all these people.
You're being honored with some incredible people. Elie Wiesel, obviously, the face of the Holocaust, the most famous surviving member. Talk to me about being in the company of such incredible people and historic people.
I'm overwhelmed, and I can't wait to meet her. I can't wait to meet everybody. It's a little overwhelming. It's exciting. And, you know, I find myself in the funniest of places. You know, I do the work that I do, and I was really, when Rabbi Shmuley called me and said, I really want the world to know and the world to know that your support of Israel, but also your support of all the great things that you do and animal rights and environmental rights and how that fits in with Israel's way of thinking. And I think it was just really a compliment. And it's always shocking, but I'm just really happy and flattered.
Episode 10, everybody, of the Chapo Trap House. You just heard from Pamela Anderson as she was being interviewed on the red carpet for the International Champions of Jewish Values Awards. And just three things right off the bat about that little clip there. First of all, she misgenders Elie Wiesel, perhaps intentionally, perhaps not. But she misgenders Elie Wiesel and then goes on to say that she likes Israel because it's one of the most vegetarian nations on the planet, and they're continuing to spread love and compassion in that regard. But actually, my favorite part about that clip was that the sort of like rent-a-pap that the Foundation for Jewish Values and Excellence hired to interview people on their phony red carpet event says that Elie Wiesel is here, one of the great surviving members of the Holocaust, like it's the fucking Beatles or something.
Okay, I'm sorry, but Elie Wiesel, no Primo Levi. Primo Levi kicks the shit out of Elie Wiesel every day. Elie Wiesel is a hip-hop style fucking sagging his pants in the locker room Holocaust survivor, and Primo Levi is just like lunch pail 9 to 5, so I totally disagree.
That's just so ignorant. Psychopath. I mean, if you listen to their solo work, there's no comparison between the two. It's just Wiesel is on a whole other level. I mean, this is typical rockist bullshit.
I actually have to agree with Felix here. If you put Knight and If This Is a Man side by side, there's no comparison. Levy is
check the pitchfork scores, okay? And I think you'll see that they support my argument here.
Matt, let me just tell you, if Primo Levi and Elie Wiesel were in a level 5 yard, Primo Levi would fucking basically be making Elie Wiesel's girlfriend if he were gay.
I actually shout out to Rob Bryan. I found out about this wonderful event that took place in New York last week through him, and found this amazing audio video clip that he linked to. It's the International Awards for Champions of Jewish Values. And then I did some research into what this event is. And basically, it's the Sheldon Adelson Award for Outstanding Achievement in the Field of Excellence.
What was Yoko Ono doing at the...
I think it's a new spoken word or some sort of art installation she was doing. I don't know. She's a champion of Jewish values. I think Sean Penn was an honoree of the previous year. So look, Israel will take them wherever they get them. You know, it's dark times. A lot of people are talking shit about it, but there are still champions out there, and they're not afraid to be honored at an event like this. So, I mean, I think it's great.
I think next year that Sinbad's got an inside track.
Kramer or Michael Richards is going to do his infamous Laugh Factory routine, but say Gazan instead.
Well, that's the other thing I love about what Rabbi Shmuley says. He was like, you know, a lot of people are talking bad about Israel, but, you know, Pam Anderson and Yoko Ono are not afraid to come out and support us this night. So what do you think? Should we start the show, guys?
Let's do it.
Let's do it.
Okay, Chapo, let's go. Roll that music. Okay, we are back. I am Will Meniker. It's episode 10. And joining me, as always, is Matt Christman.
Hello.
And Felix Biederman.
Hey, everybody.
In just a little bit, we'll be talking to foreign policy expert Derek Davison. We're going to be talking to him about, we had a long conversation with him about Iran, the Middle East, and the brain dead foreign policy and media establishment that we refer now as only as the Blob. But it was, I think, probably our most informative show yet. Before
we promise not to do that ever again.
Yeah, it was a terrible mistake. I hope you guys can grin and bear it. But before we get to that, and then actually a little bit later, we'll be talking about hysterical crackpot Rod Dreher, who's come through with, I think, a sterling entry into the Chapo reading series. But before we get to either of those two nuggets, I just want to do a little bit of house cleaning. We didn't make any news this week, but what we did make was the top 100. We cracked the top 100 on the iTunes podcast charts. How about it?
Yeah, we have surpassed Laura Ingraham, who a dime.
Along with The Economist and
those fucking nerds.
Fucking bow tie dipshit inbred morons. We killed you.
It's just we've picked
Neville Half Acre Von Swithington is sitting in his fucking office at the Thames and weeping salty tears of Worcestershire sauce.
We're tearing up the iTunes charts on the news and politics genre. And it's funny, when I was figuring out, like, you know, how to place this show when we put it on iTunes, I'm glad I chose the news and politics genre, because honestly, we straddle a lot of categories. But I'm glad I chose that one, because it's like when the wolves pick out, like, the weak and sick, like the fawn or the sick caribou, and just like attack. Because I mean, the news and politics podcast game is some weak ass shit, and we're tearing it the fuck up.
It's the weakest genre. I mean, right now we are right under the Weekly Standard podcast, which I haven't listened to, but I can imagine it's the shittiest thing on earth.
It's probably the most unbearable thing you could possibly listen to outside the Ben Shapiro show.
Yeah, it's William Crystal bragging about all the times he's taken the Acela train, and we're going to kill them next.
I saw there were some homeless people in front of the ice cream shop this week, and it just made me think, well, what is Bill de Blasio planning for some sort of revolution? I don't understand. Oh, I shit myself again.
Since when is it acceptable for Best Buy to play hip-hop style music in their stores? We have another target.
Seriously, though, the Weekly Standard is at 85 on the iTunes news and politics charts. We are at 86. And that sort of tingling feeling crawling up the arm of the Weekly Standard podcast hosts right now is, in fact, not a heart attack, or it may be in addition to a heart attack, Chapo breathing down their fat, sweaty necks. So I want to implore our listenership this week to just download the show on iTunes, even if you're listening to it on SoundCloud. Just download it on iTunes. Leave a review, because that counts, because I'm making it my life's goal to put the Weekly Standard podcast in a fucking grave, because the law prevents me from doing that to their hosts.
We have another target, though, and we, look, we hate the Weekly Standard people. We hate everyone who works there. We even hate,
I hate everyone who subscribes to it.
Auxiliary staff. We hate the subscribers. We hate the subscribers' families. But this next one, we have no hard feelings towards.
It's the Young Turks. They're next in line, and they got to go, too.
There can be only one Turk chat on here.
We're sorry. We're sorry, Sank. We're the only people that carry on the legacy of Ataturk and Pasha.
We're the only ones who care about justice and development.
That's right.
Some people like one or the other. Some people can take and leave the development, but they want the whatever. We want both, and we're not going to settle for less.
Equal parts. And if you're not down with both justice and development, then you probably will never listen to Chapo Trap House.
It's not for you, and very little on this earth is.
That's fucking A, right, Matt? Clap, clap. So we're right. Coming for you guys next, and everyone else, we will litter the fucking side of the road with your skulls. But
it's just the road, like our ascension to the throne, it will be paved with the bones of the news and politics section of the iTunes podcast charts.
We're coming for you, Jacob Weisberg.
You fucking Sylvester the cat, motherfucker.
I thought a buddy cat.
Fucking, the goddamn made a fortune on Bush Sniglets in the 90s and the late aughts.
Well, you were losing your house. Jacob Weisberg was making $5 million to talk about the time that George Bush said strategery.
By the way, it's so funny to scroll through the news and politics charts because it's like all the names of the podcast are like Econo Talk, you know, the Politico Hour. And then it's just us with that big E for explicit. And our logo is like the DEA drug, like the cocaine enforcement patch. And I mean, I love it. Like I said, I'm so glad we chose this category to destroy. But yeah, we got a ton of stuff to do. We got a great conversation with Derek Davison coming up. So why don't we get into it?
Let's
what do you do say?
It.
Yeah.
Okay. Derek, thanks for being here with us.
Sure.
You have a graduate degree in Middle Eastern studies with
two of them actually. Unfortunately.
Okay.
The University of Chicago will. PhD program for Middle Eastern Studies will not accept the University of Chicago's master's degree in Middle East Studies.
So you have
nerd.
Yeah. So yeah, you have to get another one, and then if you're me, you get a second one, and then decide you don't want the PhD, and you're stuck with two master's.
Now I'm reading from your bio here, and it also says that you have worked in the Persian Gulf for the RAND Corporation.
Many years ago, I did. I worked in Qatar.
Okay, so you know you're a legit expert on the Middle East. So I think to kick things off, I have to ask you. Let's start with this question. Do you remember your position on the Iraq War? For against it was like 13 years ago now.
Yeah,
like, it was a long time ago. So I'm sorry
country,
to start out with such.
Wait a minute. Hold on a minute. There was a war in Iraq. I'm totally drawing a blank on that. I'm stunned.
Derek, I don't mean to throw you into the deep end, like straight off the bat, but I figure
you're putting me on the
spot.
You're
an expert,
here.
So I figure you're ready for it.
I was opposed to the war.
Really?
I was opposed to the war because the WMD question bothered me, but what bothered me more was the hard sell that Iraq was involved in 9/11. When there was no evidence of this, and every time Dick Cheney went on TV and said, well, we have these reports about them meeting in Prague, and he seemed to be the only person who had reports about the 9/11 hijackers meeting with Iraqi intelligence in Prague. And it just seemed a little fishy to me, and I thought, if they had a good case for this, they would not be trying to do this kind of hard sell with no evidence.
I kind of remember that.
This is kind of coming back now that you're saying it. And I found that troubling too, but I think I ended up supporting the war mostly because of Toby Keith. I think he made the strongest case for intervention.
They should have named him the White House press secretary.
I mean, he did a better job than any of those guys at really making me feel like I was a big queer pussy if I didn't support the Iraq
there
war.
There you go.
I have to say, I proudly was against the Iraq war. But I was a member of the John Birch Society pretty much from then until like last week when Will told me I couldn't be a member of the John Birch Society and the podcast, so I had to choose. But basically, I was for a full-scale nuclear attack of everything from Turkey, as they call it, which is really just recaptured Anatolia, to Yemen. I thought it didn't go far enough, but I was probably in opposition, and I remember everything that I wrote on this on my blog, Shakespeare's Hammer.
See, the thing is that I honestly have a hard time remembering, because, I mean, 2003, it was such a crazy time. The American Idol was dividing the nation into claymates and studtards.
Was that Clay's
trilogy?
Here?
Oh, yeah, that was Clay Aiken and Ruben Studdard. And I mean, that was a real conflict. That's certainly what I was paying attention to. And the Matrix trilogy was ending. It was just a confusing period. So I don't think you can blame anybody for forgetting what they thought about it.
I actually saw the second Matrix movie in a theater in a mall in Doha, Qatar. And I remember, like, that scene where the old white dude shows up and speaks gibberish, and I wanted to scream out, what the fuck are you talking about?
You walk back out into the desert sun, and you thought, this is what we're fighting for. Yeah,
exactly. This is American Civilization 2003.
You know, if you think about it, Neo was Katib.
Felix, of course, is making reference to Saeed Khatib, the founder of political Islamism and the spiritual godfather of Al-Qaeda. I just want to do a little annotation there for people who maybe aren't as woke as us. But
one of many people on the Chapo Trap House Hall of Fame.
We've raised his jersey to the rafters.
Yeah. We got him, Erdogan.
It's just those two.
I have to say that Khatib is, I put him above all of our other guys, because Khatib proves our incel theory, that an incel is more powerful than anyone else on Earth.
He is one of the great incels. It's true.
He is. That's true.
It was, you know.
Incels conquered Jerusalem at every point. It was always incels first through the gates. Whether they were Muslim incels, Christian incels, it was always incels through the gate.
Well, you know, that was quite a bit more than 13 years ago. So I don't want to get too lost in the reeds here. I mean, I honestly can't say whether I was for or against the Crusades, but I was definitely against the war in Iraq, even though it was 13 years ago and it's hard to remember. But I do remember that. But what's not 13 years ago is Iran. And this is actually, Derek, why we wanted to have you on, because we wanted to discuss a number of things related to this big profile that was in the New York Times Magazine from a couple weeks ago about this guy, Ben Rhodes, who started out as a speechwriter, but then became sort of a very, at least according to the piece, became like one of the key people in the Obama White House, who's like a kind of Iago-like foreign policy manipulator and mastermind. And it all has to do with the selling of the Iran deal to the American public and sort of the machinations that went on behind the scenes from that, and a lot of the things that Samuels alleges in this piece we want to get into. But before we get that, sort of like Vox style, we have you, the expert, on. So could you give for us in broad strokes what was the Iran deal? Like, what did it do and what did it not do? And like, just because you give us like the broad outlines of that.
So, you know, Iran's pretty well into this, to developing their nuclear program. And they're, resistant partly on, you know, they don't want to throw away all this work that they've done, partly because it's a sort of national pride issue. They're very reluctant to just sort of scrap their entire nuclear program, which is what the Bush administration had insisted on and really what the Obama administration was insisting on for most of his first term. When they were busy, you know, adding to the sanctions regime. When the negotiations finally came together, it was the U.S. and the E3, the Germany, Britain, and France, plus the other two permanent members of the Security Council, Russia and China. So they're called the P5 plus one. The P5 are the five permanent members of the Security Council, and the one is Germany.
You down with OPP? You down with OPP?
Exactly.
Yeah, you know me.
Exactly. So it was Iran and the P5 plus one and the UN, and EU sort of all getting together to have these talks. What the final product did was it put in place a very stringent set of inspections and verification obligations that Iran is required to meet. It permitted Iran to continue to enrich uranium, which is the thing that still has most of the deal's critics up in arms, but at a lower level than it was doing, and with a lot of safeguards on the process. There's monitoring at every stage of the from the mining of the uranium
to the
enrichment process.
To enrich uranium to the point where it would be usable in a weapon, it has to be at something like 80 or 90% enrichment.
I think it's over 90.
It's at least
90%.
And right now,
and they're limited.
They're capped at about 20 or 30.
No, they're capped at 3.5%.
Oh, so that's nothing.
Which is all you need for a civilian nuclear power plant. You know, there are certain types of reactors that require 20%. The problem, the concern is that, like, for whatever reason, I'm obviously not a physicist, but getting it to 3.5% is like halfway to getting it to 90%.
I see.
Like it's much easier to enrich. You know, the more enriched it is, the easier it is to enrich it further. So the you know you've done something like half the work just to get it to 3.5%. So the terms of the deal, you know, set up the inspections regime, set up Iran's requirements to allow, you know, on-site inspections, to allow the IAEA to monitor all these things, set up very specific terms about how much uranium they're allowed to enrich, how much of a stockpile they're allowed to maintain, how highly enriched they're allowed to make it, and then also dealt with this heavy water reactor at Arak, which is being swapped out. I think already has been swapped out for something. Now, a heavy water reactor is a concern because it produces a lot of plutonium. Sorry, as a byproduct, and that's another way to get to a nuclear weapon. So there's the enriched uranium pathway to a nuclear weapon, and then there's the plutonium pathway. And the concern with Arak was that it would enable them to produce a plutonium-based weapon, but that reactor has been modified so that it produces much less plutonium, and that's really not a concern anymore.
So theoretically, this deal would stop Iran from doing the things necessary to create a nuclear weapon. And I would, you know, it's been like the kind of signature achievement of the second term of Obama. But at the same time,
yes, I mean, I would argue this and the Cuba thing are his lasting foreign policy accomplishments.
Yeah, but it's one that's been bitterly opposed by much of the right, certainly all of the right wing, all of the neoconservative right, but a lot of the sort of foreign policy establishment in America. And this is sort of where we wanted to get into this topic of this New York Times Magazine piece about this guy, Ben Rhodes, that you also wrote a response to. So could you like sort of summarize for us briefly what was in that New York Times piece and how it relates to the Iran deal?
So I started reading this thing. I think it was published late on a Wednesday night. Like I saw somebody, tweeted about it, and I opened it up, and I'm laying there, I'm in bed, you know, my wife is trying to fall asleep, and I'm sitting here reading this article, and I woke her up as she was getting to sleep to complain because like the first three paragraphs of this piece, I couldn't even get through them. I had to put it down and stop reading because I was going to have a stroke because they're about this guy, you know, Ben Rhodes was doing a master's of fine arts and decided that he wanted to write a novel about foreign policy. And so he called his mom's good friend who runs the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. And now, you know, fast forward several years, and he's the deputy national security advisor at the White House, basically because his mom knew somebody at the Carnegie Endowment. You know, and, you know, it's just – it's incredibly frustrating for somebody who has two master's degrees in the Middle East, and I'm not getting called to be the deputy national security advisor. But here's this guy with a fine arts degree, and, you know, his mom knew a person. And so I had to put it down.
You're not a bourbon bastard, though. And
well,
that's
true.
What the White House needs is more gritty – fiction writing bourbon bastards who look the world in the eye and slug back some Woodford Reserve and say, "Oh, is that all you've got?"
Have you guys ever read like the first draft of the Syrian non-binding resolution? It starts off with, "I sat at my desk, wood grain as dark as the bourbon that I was drinking. Every time I took a sip, I remembered her. Her dress twirling in the wind like the matador's cape as he went to skewer the bull. Yes, writing was a woman and I was going to fuck her." I don't know why that was in there. That like shouldn't have been in there. That's like I'm not an international lawyer, but I don't think that's binding.
It's a page turner though. I mean, you know. So,
the clock struck 8 when the planes hit the World Trade Center. Strong hearts then.
But I you know, to go back to Rhodes actually, it's, you know, when I read the thing and I talked to an editor I know, and he said a lot of this piece was shitty editing and that this guy, because of his ideological bent, the author of the piece, David Samuels, he buried the interesting part of it, which is failed novelist gets to do this because of who his mom was. And it's almost, you know, it's like the fucking Armando Iannucci joke in The Loop, where Malcolm goes into he goes into the State Department and he sees that kid and he goes, "You're fucking 12." Like,
no offense, son, but I mean, you look like you should still be at school with your head down a fucking toilet.
All of our foreign policy apparatus.
No,
well, of course. I mean, none of these guys take that for granted, because for most of these shitheads, that's how they got their jobs.
Yeah. Yeah.
So they don't see anything wrong with that. They're like, okay, yeah, mom knew somebody at the Kearney Endowment.
That's right.
That's how I got my job. Whatever. They would never think to notice that as odd or inappropriate.
That's a really good point. But like the point of this piece and what the thing that people do see as what's wrong with Rhodes is how much him and Obama, like their sort of their anger and their disdain for what they refer to, or what Rhodes refers to as, quote, the blob. And for that, it's like it's his sort of, you know, again, a very literary guy. He's making a reference to, you know, movies and television shows, as, you know, one does. But like it's his metaphor for like this sort of foreign policy consensus in the White House, and, right, and like in or like in the American, I don't know, deep state or whatever you want to call it. But so like, could you like,
it's the foreign policy establishment. It's the DC.
It's the DC foreign policy establishment.
You would have thought, though, that as a DeLillo guy, he would have called it like the airborne toxic event or something.
The airborne toxic event is a much better metaphor for the DC foreign policy establishment.
That's good. Yeah, that's very good.
And he says, okay, I'm just going to quote from the Samuels piece there. Basically, he said his ticket to the big show is when he became like an assistant. He was he wrote much of the Iraq survey, or the Iraq study group report on the Iraq war. And, you know, as one does, it says, quote, was proof in black and white, not of the complexity of international affairs or the many perils attendant on political decision making, but of the fact that decision makers were morons. And, you know, when I read that, I was like, this is supposed to be very damning of Rhodes, but honestly, he's winning me over.
Yeah, no, this made me like a guy that I was not supposed to like going into it. It's like when Donald Trump goes, Chris Eliza is the worst journalist in America. And you go, oh, holy shit, I'm supposed to be mad about this.
And, okay, so let me just quote from Samuels.
You know, he's got a point.
Once again about Rhodes. It said, he had also developed a healthy contempt for the American foreign policy establishment, including editors and reporters at the New York Times, the Washington Post, the New Yorker, Jeffrey Goldberg, and elsewhere, who at first applauded the Iraq war and then sought to pin any and all blame on Bush and his merry band of neocons when it quickly turned sour. If anything, that anger had grown fiercer during Rhodes' time in the White House. He referred to the foreign policy establishment as the blob, and according to him, that included Hillary Clinton, Robert Gates, and other Iraq war promoters from both parties who now whine incessantly about the collapse of American security order in Europe and the Middle East. So again, when I read that, I was like, damn, yeah, Rhodes is a young savage. We should have him on the Chapo.
It made me think I want to read his novels, too.
So, Derek, like, just... like what in like the blob as the foreign policy establishment, like what does the blob believe? Like what are the assumptions of the blob, and how did the Iran deal and like the second term of the Obama administration counter that?
The main assumption I think you have to have to be in the blob is belief in the ability of American military force to do great and wonderful things in the world. The impetus to always be doing something. That profile of Hillary Clinton in the Times a couple of weeks ago, you know, how she became a hawk, talks about her presumption to take action. If there's a situation where there's risks to doing something or risks to not doing something, she prefers to be caught doing something. That's it. I mean, that's the DC... that's the blob. I mean, the idea that it's always better to be doing something than not to be doing something. And for some reason, errors of action are less,
More forgivable
than errors of inaction. Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
And this goes back to that famous Rove quote, or it was never actually attributed to Rove, but in what's his name in Susskind's book, where he says that we're history's actors, and that you basically are the theater critic, i.e. journalists, are, you know, you'll record our actions, but when you get done recording, we'll act again and create a new reality. Okay, so the portrait that he creates in it is of Rhodes as, like I said, this kind of Iago-like figure who's using both his contempt for the news media and foreign policy establishment, but also his knowledge of how they work, to kind of sell the case for the Iran deal to the American people, and then as Samuels portrays it, as sort of manufacturing consent, you know, to use the old right. phrase. And again, when I read this, I thought, well, thank God if we can manufacture a case to get into a war. I'm glad there's some people who know how to manufacture a case to keep us out of a fucking war.
Well, and it's, I mean, he says, Rhodes at one point in the piece, I think, says, you know, it would be nice if we could have a reasoned debate and put this up to a vote, but that just ain't going to happen. It's not America 2016.
Because there were...
And he's right.
A huge amount of political weight was arrayed against this deal, like 100%, like to the death.
Yes,
to an obsessive degree. Like, I mean, obviously, like the neoconservative establishment, this is like their, like, you know, year zero, basically.
I mean, yeah. I mean, Iran is. I mean, they're, you know, they're all Captain Ahab, and Iran is their white whale, basically.
These guys were as sad the day that the Iran deal was signed as they were happy on 9/11.
Can you? The sort of enmity between these people and Iran, it goes back a while to the revolution and the torturing and killing of William F. Buckley. Not the guy who fucked Ross Douthat, but the CIA. I mean, they're both CIA agents, but the CIA one in Lebanon. So can you talk a little bit about why they just fucking hate Iran and Shia Muslims at large so much?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the revolution and the hostage crisis were... There were crimes committed against Americans, and, you know, certainly the hostage taking in Lebanon that went on in the 80s. These were, you know, condemnable things. I mean, that Iran was involved in, you know, targeting Americans. But I think that it's almost a psychological thing at this point. Like the embassy hostage taking, and then, you know, the botched operation to free them. These were serious blows to, you know, America's image of itself, you know, in 1979 or 1980, you know, to its sort of, to our own self-image of our place in the world and our, you know, omnipotence. And they haven't really gotten over that.
Like, these were...
And it's led us to some horrible policies. Like, I mean, it led us to support Saddam Hussein throughout the 80s during that war, which was just awful. From a humanitarian moral standpoint, from a standpoint of policy. I mean, we wound up going to war with this fucking guy, you know, a year after or two years maybe after the Iran-Iraq war ended. He was that bad for us. You know, it led us to commit atrocities. I mean, you know, we shot down an Iranian passenger plane. We participated in, you know, military action against Iranian oil facilities in the Persian Gulf. So, you know, it sort of drove the foreign policy establishment crazy when that happened in 79. And they're just...
It's like that, the image of that helicopter crashed in the desert, and like the idea that Iran, which went from being like a major state within the U.S. orbit to completely opposed to it almost overnight with the Islamic Revolution...
Right.
We're like two right. concrete, you know, real examples of like the limits of American power at the time. We're like post-Vietnam and I guess like the dawn of the Reagan 80s and like this sort of neoconservative ideology, which did not recognize any limits to American power whatsoever. This is getting to like the sort of broader question I want to get to you about the blob and U.S. and the sort of like weird schizophrenic U.S. foreign policy, because like... Okay, like Iran, I could see them being a major enemy in like the 80s, you know, like they you know, the mullahs made for that good like action movie bad guy. But like post 9/11 now, jihad and like the actual American civilians killed by terrorist acts seems to be almost exclusively a Sunni franchise. And one is that we're now learning funded largely by the Saudis and other Gulf states. Yet for the people who
funded by individuals in the Gulf states.
Funded by individuals in the Gulf states. Okay.
Yeah. Whether they're funded by the governments is a, you know, much dicier question.
Again, I don't want to get sued by Saudi Arabia on the show. but yet again, Iran seems to be like, okay, when the war in Iraq happened, the people who plotted that out and like the people who dreamed of this for years and years and years, like the Dick Cheney's and the neoconservative movement, Iraq was just like the intro for them. Iran was always their number one target and still is.
Yes, there was now. Let me dig this out because there was a quote. There was a quote in Newsweek. The quote was, and this was right before the invasion of Iraq. Everyone wants to go to Baghdad, but real men want to go to Tehran.
Oh, I remember that quote. Who said that?
I had that big dog T-shirt.
I think it was anonymous. So yeah. I mean, the goal, you know, Iraq was sort of the appetizer for the main course, which was Iran.
It was going to be the staging area, right?
Yeah. It was going to be the staging area, and you can imagine that some of these guys, if they would have been able to look ahead and see that there was going to be no appetite for war with Iran, might not have supported the Iraq war, because the Iraq war in the end did a lot of positive things for Iran's foreign policy. I mean, it was a good thing for them, right?
Yeah, like the people look back and they say, well, how could you not see that Iraq was going to be pulled into the Iranian orbit if you overthrew Saddam? And they would probably, if they were honest, admit, yeah, we assumed that we'd overthrow Iran too.
Right.
Because I mean, it only works if Iran is also overthrown.
We would never have given that a chance to happen, right? I mean, it would have been right on to Iran right now, you know.
So
the question I have is okay, so we've got this interesting kind of civil war in the foreign policy establishment between the sort of embedded elements and the conventional wisdom and the Obama administration. But obviously, for many left perspectives, the Obama administration has had a pretty bad foreign policy, obviously. Lots of blood, lots of awfulness. I mean, right now, you know, from drone wars to supporting the slaughter in Yemen to arming the quote-unquote moderate rebels in Syria. It's a fucking Libya. It's a shit show from top to bottom. But you still have these deeply powerful elements within the foreign policy establishment, not just Republicans on the outside or anything, actively working against Obama on the premise that he's too soft. And it kind of makes me have the sad, depressed thought that this half-assed imperialism that Obama has had, where it's like, and you kind of saw it at the very beginning of his term when he had the question of the surge in Afghanistan. And it was, you know, they were saying 40,000 and people were saying, no, how about we don't do that? And he ended up going, okay, how about 20,000? Just at every point, like just trying to put out as little as trying to do as much as he could to avoid them totally backstabbing him, but no more. Is this as good as we can ever expect a president's foreign policy to be, given the institutional pushback it receives?
Unfortunately, my suspicion is that, yes, it is as good as you're going to get for some time to come. And you're right. I mean, it's been a sort of imperialism light. It's, you know, I think the policy that illustrates this the best is the first term, and they've kind of ratcheted it back since then, but the first term, drone policy, which was, you know, so dismissive of national sovereignty in a way that we would never tolerate anybody else flying unmanned drones over United States territory and picking people off at will.
Actually, I think we would let Amazon do that.
We won't go to war with you. Like, we won't invade you, but we will fly these aircraft over your airspace, whether you like it or not, and, you know, launch missiles at people inside your borders. And that's, I think, it's sort of the imperialism, you know, the watered down version.
It's like from reading all of the stuff this week in prep for this interview about Obama's view on military force, it seems like he just wishes that it was all apps. Like, he wished that he had a drone app and a JSOC app And he could just, like, Uber some missiles to the terrorists and not have to deal with anything other than that, not have to push out any other commitments.
These little, you know, limited operations, which, again, I mean, it's, you know, it's better than invading another country, but it's still not good. And yet, I think, as you say, I think we're going to struggle to... we're going to look fondly back on these days, I think.
Yeah, that's the scary thing.
At some
thing.
Point in I the think, next, yeah, during the next administration.
It's likely to get only worse. There's really there's no precedent for it being better for what's on the horizon.
So a response to that, a view from inside the blob comes courtesy of David Samuels himself, the guy who wrote the profile of Ben Rhodes. And it's one of the things that you pointed out in your sort of response to the piece is that Samuels wrote an article in Slate in 2009 just asking the question, or just sort of like, you know, gaming out why it would be a good idea for Israel to bomb Iran's nuclear facilities, like even absent any sort of consent or warning for the United States, right?
Right. Right.
And he said, it's the surest way for Israel to restore the image of strength and unpredictability that made it valuable to the United States after 1967, while also eliminating Iran as a viable partner. The fact that this approach may be the international relations equivalent of keeping your boyfriend by shooting the other cute girl he likes in the head is an indicator of the difference between high school romance and alliances between states. I mean, I think he's making the case that alliances between states are exactly like high school romances here.
Can I just say there is a lot going on here. There's a lot going on in
just psychologically.
Yeah, I'd like to go to first that Israel needs to be dangerous and unpredictable.
A bad boy.
Yeah, the Ike Turner of states. Stanley in a streetcar named Desire. Just all desirable things in statecraft. But also, he gets in this Elliot Rodger territory where, like, that's the best analogy he can come up with. Where he's like, it's like when you shoot somebody in the head to maintain a relationship. Like, we've all done that. Like,
yeah, who among us hasn't?
We certainly have imagined it and fantasized about it repeatedly if we haven't done it.
Yeah, Ben Rhodes has just complete contempt for the supreme gentleman that make up the foreign policy apparatus.
But this guy Samuels has quite a dossier himself, both in the idea that he's writing this kind of slash fic about Israel bombing Iran, but also that he was on this panel at the Hudson Institute.
Hudson, which
is another neocon think tank that was, again...
Named after Ernie Hudson.
the greatest Ghostbuster of all. But what was that panel at the Hudson Institute about?
The panel was titled "What's Wrong with the Proposed Nuclear Deal with Iran." It was in April of last year, and Samuels was there. I mean, literally, they asked him. Lee Smith was moderating, and you know, when it came his turn to speak, Lee Smith teed it up for him by saying, you know, what are we doing wrong in trying to convince people of, you know, how bad this deal is? How can we do a better job? So he's literally there to, like, coach these guys on how to do a better media presentation for the anti-deal, agenda. He talked for a very long time and went into this very long, like, for sort of slow wind-up comment, the upshot of which was that the Iran deal represents sort of the abandonment of 70 years of international consensus over nuclear proliferation, which is total bullshit. But, you know, this is his concern, that we're abandoning non-proliferation, we're going to let the Iranians do whatever they want, and this is just terrifying. That was his contribution.
This is the standard
the
kind
panel.
Of like the liberal concern trolling, where you're concerned about it from a stereotypically liberal point of view, right?
Right, right. You know,
as you're seated next to like some guy with an eye patch and like fucking, you know, some like, sort of like, you know, blood dripping
bomb
from his mouth
Iran on his t-shirt. Yeah, and you know, like, I'm not It's not about Iran. I'm worried about the international consensus.
Well,
you know, like, come on.
I mean, well, you raised both of these things in your response to the Samuels piece, and then he did a response to that that doesn't name you at all. You're
no.
curiously absent
I mean,
from
I,
that, but.
I've gotten used to these.
Well, you're not in the blob. You're not even like in the counter blob.
I'm not in the blob. But
your
I
mom doesn't
get,
know
I
anybody
get...
at the Carnegie Endowment. Fuck off.
But what I like about
I did get I you know Fred Kaplan linked to it at Slate, and that you know Fred Kaplan's piece then became the response. And
well, I just want to quote.
You know, I'm happy to you know.
Well, you got under his skin because without naming you, he responds to every single point that you made. And we're going to link to both of these things, by the way. But first, I just want to quote from Samuels here. He says of the Slate piece, he says, like a lot of Slate articles, it was meant to be intentionally provocative.
Just shaking things up.
It unfolds as an exercise yeah. in rational choice, superpower client state theory.
Yes.
Oh, it's that old rational like, choice, superpower that, client state theory. Oh, I got it.
Where you shoot a bitch
yeah.
in the head.
Yeah.
just ends with me shooting the boyfriend of my creepy teenage obsession
hey,
in the head.
Yeah, it's like when your man be stepping out, don't take it to him. Find that bitch and hit her with a car.
This is like in the Carrie Underwood song Before He Cheats, but applied to massive nuclear annihilation.
I don't want to give the impression that the blob is all just, you know, mama's boys and morons and just like, you know, deeply deluded. So I want to be fair here.
No, Hillary Clinton's.
Yeah, I want to be fair here and read one more thing from Inside the Blob. And I figure if you're going to, you know, be critical of something, you should engage with the best minds, the best arguments that they have. And now, of course, I'm talking about Richard Cohen of the Washington Post. Linda. Let's just all whisper. Really, the wind whispers Linda whenever I say the name Richard Cohen. But I'm going to read. This is he wrote an op-ed piece in the Washington Post again about the Ben Rhodes David the piece that David Samuels wrote about Ben Rhodes. I'm just going to read the first paragraph here because this is like you know directive from Central Command of the blob. Sorry, Richard Cohen writes. I've read a fair number of books on foreign policy in recent years. Wait,
why does he do this? He's like the master of the self-own.
It gets like,
remember
it gets
that
better.
Column that he wrote years a couple years ago where he was like, you know, I'm a funny guy. I know.
That was about the Colbert White House Correspondents Dinner and how
right,
it was
right,
tasteless
right.
and over the line. And it started off with, I'm a funny guy. All of my interns say I'm hilarious.
It gets so much better. Here he goes. He opens with, this is the first sentence was, okay. I've read a fair number of books on foreign policy in recent years. Yet the one that has made the greatest impression on me was assigned in the sixth grade. It was Esther Forbes' novel Johnny Tremaine. And the lesson
Oh my God.
And the lesson I took from it, the very one that Johnny himself had to learn the hard way, pride goeth before the fall. Maybe too late. I recommend the book to President Obama and his foreign policy team. Their pride has already turned to smugness. First of all, I remember reading Johnny Tremaine probably around the same time. I don't remember pride goeth before the fall being the lesson, but I don't know. I just remember the guy gets his hand deformed in some kind of smelting accident and joins the Revolutionary War. So, and then Richard Cohen goes on and on and on because basically Ben Rhodes calls him a moron. Just, you know, he subtweets the Richard Cohens of the world throughout this piece. And, you know, sorry, let me just read his closing thing. He goes, if this is success, what constitutes failure? When Obama and his mind-melded sidekick proclaim their own brilliance and the failure of almost everyone else, what are they talking about? Maybe the president could use some obnoxious aides who challenge him and don't come at him puppy-like. First, though, they could use some humility. In the Times piece, Rhodes is likened to Holden Caulfield. That's not who came to my mind. I thought of Johnny Tremaine.
That is poetic.
So yeah, these are
that is literature.
Yeah, this Richard Cohen is the person who is like He's metabolizing the blob and spitting it out to us in its purest form.
But he's not, I mean, Richard Cohn, to even, like, he's basically at this point being like, oh yeah, you know that disgusting organization of sociopathic freaks and liars? I'm part of that. But even they would be like, no, you're not. You're fucking not. Like, get the fuck out of here. even them, even all the people from, like, the fucking, the Bahraini Institute for Rubber Bullets, or all these evil people would be like, no, Richard Cohn has nothing to do with us.
Where do you see, like, let's say, Hillary Clinton going with all this? Is she going to continue this? Because she was put against Obama in a lot of this. She wanted the red line in Syria to be maintained. She pushed hard for Libya, and she's generally probably a more hawkish person. Like, how do you imagine a Hillary Clinton foreign policy shaking out?
I used to say it was about a 40% chance that she would abrogate the Iran deal. I've kind of come down from that. I think it's more maybe 10 to 25% chance that she will at some point do something that negates the Iran deal. You'll see the two, you know, like I said, I think the two lasting achievements of the Obama administration will be, you know, opening with Cuba and the Iran deal. Unfortunately, because of Hillary Clinton's predilections, I think that the Iran deal will not be as transformative as it could have been. I mean, as the first step toward real diplomatic engagement with Iran, it could have been quite a change for American foreign policy, and I don't think she's gonna touch that with a 10-foot pole.
All right, Derek, if people wanna read more of you, where should they go?
Go to Loblog. That's where I get all virtually these days of my freelance stuff published. Or they can come to my blog. It's attwiw.com. The name of the blog is "And That's the Way It Was." I do a lot of writing about history there, because that's what I really like doing, but also, you know, analysis of things that are going on around the world.
Sounds good. Everyone should check that out. Derek, thanks so much for talking to us.
Sure. Thanks for having me. This is a blast. But he never wrote a song for Linda, and she
Okay, so that was Derek Davison. That was awesome. I learned a lot. I hope you did. As we've said before, if there were any justice in this universe and we were not ruled by the blob, Derek would have a six-figure job explaining shit to people at Vox. Actually, he would have a job just explaining shit to the staff at Vox.
Yeah.
Forget their readers. He would just learn them something for once in their fucking lives. Okay, so... hope you guys learned something from that, but hopefully we'll learn you some more amazing shit with this week's entry in the Chapo reading series, which I think is A+. It's a banger. And this week's entry comes to us courtesy of Rod Dreher. Now, I don't know if you're familiar with Rod Dreher. He's a little bit under the radar, but he's actually probably my favorite crackpot going right now. I think he's like the hottest underground crackpot there is. He is a hysteric of the first order, and I think he's sort of like on a Kevin Williamson level in that he's interesting because he's like not purely an idiot. Like, he's not stupid, but just everything he believes in is insane, and like he can't, like, there's no filter, like he can't help but be crazy. So that's why he's entertaining, and why this week's when I saw this story this week, I knew we had to do it on the show in the reading series, because it's amazing, and it combines like three or four elements that are running themes for us on Chapo Trap House, and those would be superhero movies, people who are compulsive liars, and trans bathroom issues.
Yeah, just a little word about Rob Dreher before we start. I was talking to Virgil Texas, the co-writer of The Dig and many great articles elsewhere that I've done with him today. The Azerbaijan to our podcast. And we were talking about Rob Dreher, and we realized Rob Dreher was just born too early. If he was born in 1962, and he has all these weird sexual repressions and compulsions, and he was like, oh, I have to be religious, and because Rob Dreher is retarded, he switched around to 50 religions, from Samoan Mormonism to Eastern Orthodox, as he is now. But if Rob Dreher was born in 1992, he would just be like, I'm a cute boy who am asexual. Because that's what he is. And that would be like, that would be fine. But instead, he has to do this thing and like just air out his weird psychosis in front of you.
That's the fourth thing that this reading combines, is our study of sexual pathology and sex science.
He would be so much happier if he were doing Steven Universe fanfic on Tumblr.
He should be like all these hard right wing religious guys are always like the Tumblr safe space people, but it's like, you probably should be that. Like, that's
What is the Benedict option, which is he's the main exponent of, if not just a massive seeking out of a safe space?
Well, as you will find out, this article that he's written is very much about the search for a conservative safe space. Okay, so let's just dive into it. This is an article that he wrote at his blog this past week at the American Conservative. And the title of it is America at the Movies 2016. And in this article, he relates a story that his friend told him. So this is sort of like, you know, a game of telephone we're playing here. But when I read this to you, I just, for you, the listener, first of all, if you haven't done so already, do what we always do, Google image search Rod Dreher. So, you know, you can like have a picture in your mind for when we roast the shit out of this motherfucker. But and number two is when I read this to you, just try to imagine an adult human being believing any of this story, or at least pretending to believe it to write a column. Okay, you guys ready? Rod begins. I just got a phone call from an old friend in North Texas. She does a lot of work with law enforcement, especially in the area of domestic violence counseling and response. I hope she will not mind me saying, but she's a tough Texas chick. She called to tell me what she and her teenage son dealt with last night at the movies in Frisco, a prosperous suburb of Dallas. I thought I knew what was going on in this country, she said. I was wrong. Okay, you guys ready for this? By the way, she related this whole story to Rod over like a video chat in a dark room, holding a flashlight under her chin the entire time when she told him this story. She had taken her teenage son to see Captain America: Civil War for his birthday. In line behind them,
nerd.
we'll get to that in a second, but in line behind them, waiting to buy tickets, stood several men in their early 30s who were obviously transgendered, and a young woman who presented as a man, though she was plainly a female. My friend, quote, N, she's being referred to as N throughout the story, and his friend's name is actually just the N-word. Okay, so my friend N-word said the group started talking about sex, including their favorite positions, their favorite sex toys, you name it. One of the group was 20. An older transgender said to him, quote, you're just a kid now, but when you turn 21, we're going to take you out and get you broken in. They proposed an orgy. Okay, so that's just one paragraph right now, but there's already so much to discuss about this. So where do you guys want to begin with this story?
All right, let's start off with a nerd kid who like is probably going to end up like Rob Dreher, because he is asexual and is like, oh boy, I'm turning 15. I sure as hell don't want to drink Red Dog and have a sexual experience. I want my mom, who is friends with Rob Dreher, like that's what a fucking weirdo my mom is, to take me to see Captain America.
Yeah, so it's her teenage son on his birthday wants to go to see a Marvel movie with his mom and no one else. That's the first box we're going to tick off on just one paragraph. The second is who the fuck waits in line to buy tickets at a movie theater anymore?
Yeah, I'm sorry, but if you're not buying them online and you're waiting around in the lobby like a fucking asshole, like, you deserve to be harassed.
Okay, that's two. Next there is this gang of transgenders. And this starts out, keep in mind, he says several men in their early 30s. They're waiting behind them in line, and there's one who's a female who presents as a man, and they start talking about sex, including their favorite positions, their favorite sex toys, you name it. And he closes the paragraph by saying they proposed an orgy. What I love about this is, like, this is clearly, like, you know, the invention in the mind of someone who, like, never thinks or talks about sex, trying to invent, like, what they think someone who's, like, really dirty and uncouth would talk about. Like, hello, fellow sex perverts. Might you share with me your favorite sex position and toy? I like the vibrating egg that goes in my asshole. Would you like to have an orgy later?
Yeah, it's like 40-year-old virgin. They're all like, oh, I can't wait till we get down with sex later. I hope we jump up and down in the bed and you touch my butt and we feel both of our penises and I put the skin of mine on yours.
Okay.
I'm going to blow into your butthole. It's going to be amazing. And of course, you've got the extra hilarity of them saying, you're a 20-year-old kid, but wait till your next birthday. Then we're going to bust you out. You're thinking of the drinking age, moron.
Yeah,
there's nowhere in the country is the legal sexual consent age 21. You're thinking
and
of the drinking age.
And this is funny because he introduces it by saying his friend N-Word works with law enforcement in the area of domestic violence counseling and response. You'd think she would know the difference between the drinking age and the age of consent law. I don't know. Maybe it's different.
I also like how they proposed an orgy. Like, that's how, if we all remember our favorite Chapo reading, which was Ross Dudat's sex cruise with William F. Buckley and Jamie Kirchick. It's like something that William F. Buckley would have said then. Ducky, I propose an orgy.
What say you, young gentleman? Are you up for it, or is your blood just not strong enough?
Oh, William, I would love to have an orgy. I really, really would.
There was general consensus on the excellence of having an orgy.
Okay. I certainly would, Mr. Buckley, but I did not bring my cock ring. Oh, don't worry. We have a whole bushel full. Here, use this one. It was Augusto Pinochet's favorite.
Ben, boat boy Ben, could you fetch me the vibrating egg, please, and firmly insert it into my rectum?
Jamie said, oh, I don't know if I'm ready to have an orgy. And I said, Jamie, there comes a time in a man's life that he must look back and think, oh, I could have told my grandchildren that I had my boy pussy stretched out by William F. Buckley.
But this is the difference between conservatives and these radical genderqueer freaks, is that conservatives need to go on a boat into international waters before they do all this filth away from the ears.
Where anything's
of
legal, baby. Just and they're afraid to say no because there's nowhere else to be.
Well, it's just at least away from the tender ears of teenage boys trying to go to a movie with their mother. Okay, but back to the story. That's just one paragraph, and we already noticed about five just glaring fucking, I don't even know what to, just five red flags already. So back to Rod here. He says, on and on like this. Okay, keep in mind he said there were several transgender men waiting with them online. Now it goes on. More transgenders joined them, not waiting in line, but moving towards the front to stand with their friends. N told me that the trans group was very aware of itself and did not care who heard their filthy talk. The trans group has become self-aware, people.
On May 2016, Transnet became self-aware. This is when the war
began. It launches a bunch of dick-shaped rockets at everybody.
My CPU is a neural net processor, a fucking computer.
I know why you go to the correct bathroom, but it is something that I cannot do.
Come on me if you want to live.
Okay, sorry. Why didn't you go to the theater management and ask them to say something to the transgenders? I said, because the group would have known it was me, she said. I would have had to have left the line. Plus, in this environment, I doubted they would have done anything. Nobody wants to risk being called a bigot.
This fucking line for the movie theater that's like a goddamn Soviet bread line or like a line at Six Flags.
Yeah, you know, you don't want to lose. And let's be honest, they wouldn't respect, you know, holding any place in line. They would just cut you right away. She said, okay, she said that after they went into the theater, but before the movie started, the trans group continued their foul, verbally abusive behavior. N asked her son if he wanted to go to the bathroom before the movie started. He told her he did not feel safe doing that. Okay, so you knew that was coming. And okay,
gotta be about the bathrooms, man. Always yeah. comes back to the bathrooms.
It's coming back to the bathrooms, obviously. But there's two things to note about this. First of all, we've already noted how weird it is that a teenage boy on his birthday is going to see a movie alone with his mother. Number two, she's asking them before the movie starts if he needs to go to the bathroom. She's like checking in with him to see if he needs to pee, like he's maybe 5 or 6 years old. And then number two, if these are men who are trans women, if these are trans women, they would be using the ladies' bathroom.
Yeah, and that's son, the whole thing that makes
that's
them
the whole
horrifying.
Fucking point.
If they were into the men's room, that would be what they're supposed to do, according to these assholes.
Yeah, your son, N-word Jr., would be perfectly safe going to the men's bathroom at the movie theater because the trans women, it's you who are in danger, N. She doesn't
yeah,
even realize
Yeah, they're trying
that.
To molest women and girls. That's the whole thing that makes it bad. You don't even know your own bullshit story.
According to, like, N-word and Rob Dreher, it's like, trans people, do not go to the bathroom of your genitalia. Do not go to the other bathroom. Don't even go to the bathroom. Just figure something out. It's ridiculous.
Shit in your fucking popcorn box. That's your only option.
That would be that. That's more filth. Okay. Rod goes on. It was he's sort of like moving out of the story and into his commentary about this 100% real story, this real thing that happened. Again, I just want to call back. Keep in mind how many they were when the story began. It was just one night at the movies. Granted, and any sort of person could be a jackass at the movies. What got to N was that this trans group, she described them as over 20 people. So in the course of a few paragraphs, it went from being four transgenders to a group of over 20, like a mob, like a fucking wilding gang of transgenders.
What does that mean?
Rise.
That this group of 20 people was so confident in itself that its members thought they had no responsibility to anyone or else around them or to respect civility. That and the fact that no one dared confront them over their obnoxious behavior, either not wanting the hassle or thinking that nothing would be done by the authorities running the theater because trans folk are this week's chosen people. That's all a theater chain needs. National headlines saying that it is hateful to trans people.
This is the scene from one of those Kevin Sorbo God's Not Dead movies, and you could plot it out immediately in your head if you just imagine it. Like a young woman, maybe Melissa Joan Hart, is there with her son, and she goes to a movie theater manager and she says, "Can you do something about these people?" And he just looks at the camera.
Are gender yeah, they're, fluiding, they're, my boy.
Yeah, they're all over the place, and he looks into the camera and says, "Sorry, lady. That's just how things are now."
By the way, if you wish any of those transgenders a Merry Christmas, you are going to jail.
Okay, so here's where it actually turns to, I think, like, if this story wasn't weird enough already, like, here's the kind of turn at the end of it that really, like, kicks it into a really dark place. Rod says, after our conversation, N texted, "I found it very ironic that we went to see the movie Civil War last night. What I watched go on outside that theater while we were in line and inside the theater made me realize a civil war is coming. It is undeniable at this point. I kept thinking, someday. You know how you think that? Someday it'll get bad. Someday we'll have to take a hard stand. Someday people will be persecuted for their beliefs. Rod, it's not someday anymore. It's in our face, and I can easily see where this erupts into extreme violence. I can easily see where a civil war is coming." So she goes. She takes this fucking made-up story, this obviously bullshit story about a gang of transgenders at the Captain America movie, and fucking uses it as an excuse to start fantasizing about some like Turner Diaries type shit.
Yeah, I mean, let's think about this. Let's assume, and this is a massive assumption, that this actually happened. Let's take that leap, that massive leap. What is more disturbing behavior? Some people being assholes at movie theater, which happens every day, everywhere, regardless of people's gender presentation, or someone watching people be a dick at a movie theater and thinking, I can't wait until it's legal for me to murder you.
I mean that, like, when, like, you say it like that, it's fucking plainly obvious. Like, think how fucking disturbing that is. Like, think how fucking like how warped the mindset of, like, where, again, like, this whole point of this thing is how victimized, like, Rod and N and her beautiful teenage son are, but, like, they're literally using, like, some, like you said, if we're gonna take this at face value, some people being rude in a movie theater and then fantasizing about how the day will come soon for extreme violence, but
the,
like,
cleansing fires will come.
One day a real rain will come and wash all this trans scum out of our movie theaters.
Yeah, I want to hear from the guy who is sitting behind this lady as she's rocking back and forth and saying, oh, the judgment is upon us. The judgment is upon us.
Do you know how fucking badass the conservative welfare state is? That it's, you know, just a bunch of dark money going to these shitty publications that have never made any money and never will. It pays for Rob Dreher, who is an insane person. I know that Will said that Sean Davis from The Federalist is the weirdest motherfucker on earth, but I think it's Rob Dreher. Rob Dreher is writing out his fantasy of going fucking James Holmes on a theater full of trans people. And if you want to, like, look at it this optimistically, you're like, all right, Rob Dreher is insane in writing his homicide fantasies, but, like, he would be homeless otherwise.
Well, like, okay, here's the thing. Like, I said at the beginning of this, like, imagine being an adult human being and believing even a single word of this horseshit story. But, like, the thing about Rod is, like, whether it's true or not doesn't matter, because, like, he really wants this to be true. Like, to any, like, normal person, like, this story obviously didn't happen. But for someone like Rod, who lives his entire life in a state of, like, moral and sexual hysteria, like, he needs this story to be true to, like, justify the constant, like, froth and feeling of, like, you know, being under siege that he lives with 24/7.
Because he wants to kill these people for existing. He doesn't want to kill them for raping people in bathrooms or being assholes at movie theaters. He wants to kill them because they exist and their existence vexes him. But that's kind of a hard sell. So he wants these things to be true so that he can have some sort of concrete real-world imposition that he can point to and say, see, they're making us do this. Yeah, when in reality, yeah, he just wants them to be gone.
You know what Rod would have been good at?
Because it subsets his weird dick.
Rod would have been really good as, like, a radio host on one of those Hutu stations during the Rwandan genocide.
Yeah.
Hey, everybody, it's Radio Rwanda here, kicking off another block of...
It's the cockroach countdown, folks. Find those trans people. They're at the movie theaters now.
Rob Dreher would have fucking slayed as a radio host also under the Quisling administration.
By the way, Felix, do you keep calling him Rob?
I call him Rod, but I think, well, like, my brain is like, oh, that's Rod Dreher, but my mouth is like, who gives a shit?
Well, because who the fuck is named Rod? In the fucking 21st century, who is named Rod? Get over yourself.
Yeah, go fuck yourself. Your name's Rob. I don't care.
So, you're Rob. There's like just a fucking human. Your name's Rob.
There's just one more punchline to this story. He gets to the end of it, and his closing line is, the movie theater incident is a broken window moment. We will have plenty more of them. And then right underneath it, there's just a big bold update. Comments closed because of trolls. And I want to say, Rob, that was me. I did that to you, buddy. I closed your comment section because I was the one who tweeted about this shit. It got like 500 RTs, and everyone was making fun of you in your comment section, buddy, because of me. So actually, we're almost done, but obviously this trans bathroom thing is going to be a big issue in the campaign, right? This is going to be a huge issue in the election. I can already say
no, I don't think
Trump
so.
Kind
I
of punches it.
Yeah?
Yeah. Because Trump was the guy who said, who gives a shit about the bathrooms? Okay. So it's going to be hard for them to use it.
Like, so this is just another case of, like, showing how little the fucking internet matters. You go to Facebook, it's just all people frothily jacking off about, like, catching a sicko in the bathroom.
Well, fucking but, rip like, your dick off and flush it down the toilet if you're
I see a trans with my daughter, I'm going to fucking kill him. But, like, this is, like, these people all day. But, and this is all that Ted Cruz ran on for the last 3 months of his campaign, was like, I'm going to keep the trans people out of the bathroom. And he just got his fucking ass kicked. Like, it doesn't matter.
Yeah, in Heartland, Indiana, he was like, don't you want to protect your children at the bathroom? And they're like, nah, we don't really give a shit about
the bathrooms. Nah, fuck
you,
yeah.
I have a feeling it's gonna just, I mean, I don't know, maybe Facebook is a bad barometer. But I think
what'll
back.
Matter, maybe it's like statewide races, maybe guys who okay. are trying, you know, well, maybe the Senate and House level.
Maybe it's wishful thinking on my part, because like if this gets much bigger, it gave me a good idea for like a sort of a scheme and scam maybe that I'd like to pursue with the Street Fight guys, Brian and Brett, because I know they're always on the lookout.
Shout
for,
out to
like,
them.
Schemes and scams, and I had the idea to like you could rent out like a couple porta potties and just park it outside Target and like charge people for access to like a gender segregated bathroom experience.
No, because those people are boycotting Target. It's not going to work. They're not even going to Target now. The people who really give a shit have not decided that they're going to boycott Target. So
okay, well this idea
you're
going
to have to
work-
find another place. Yeah,
this idea needs some workshopping, but you know
maybe Walmart. I don't know. It has potential. Though, I think
there's some potential there with this idea, and hopefully I don't know. I'd be interested to see what the Street Fight guys can do with it, because I think they're, you know, natural grifters and con men.
Yeah, absolutely. We mean that in the best way.
Yeah, and let this be another plug for Street Fight, the godfather of Chapo. Really, if you like us, check out Street Fight with Brett Payne and Brian Quimby. All right, so I think it's time to close out the show with the duck hunt. Should we hunt a duck and say goodbye?
We got a really flat-faced, fat-faced, thumb-faced, whatever you want to call him, duck, who did not stray far away from Mother Duckling.
All right. Roll the tape. Felix, big up the duck. Big up our duck this week.
All right, I want to give a shout-out to our fucking boy, the founder of America Blog, the 14th out of the 20 must-read liberal blogs of 2005, John Arevosis. What up? Your last name sounds like a respiratory disorder. Your face looks like a ham with some eyes hastily scrawled on it in mascara. And you write like a bitch.
John, buddy, you may not remember or claim not to remember what your position on the Iraq War was in 2003. You can be damn sure most of us do. And for your crimes against the discourse, I'm going to hire a gang of sort of rowdy-looking youths on BMX bikes to wait outside your house and follow you around, just circling you on their BMX bikes like sharks, taunting you and teasing you about mother.
In the early 2000s, there was a horrible comedian named Steve Odekirk who made these movies where he would spoof Hollywood blockbusters but have all the characters played by thumbs with faces drawn on them. John, you look exactly like all of the thumbs in those movies. Thumbtanic, Thumb Wars, that's you. You're a fucking joke. You have an insanely high regard for yourself, even though your blog has not been relevant since George W. Bush choked on that pretzel. Remember that? That was some epic win for you. That was some traffic. I was sure you were able to buy some fucking Bugle Boys with that money when that happened. But you're a pathetic loser, and I'm going to get one of those giant fatheads that people wave behind free throw lines at basketball games and follow you around and have everybody gawk at what a gigantic pressed ham mutant face you've got.
John, I am going to leave horrible Yelp reviews for the motel that you and your mother run together.
Mother's motel must be good. Good hotel for mother. Smooth sheets.
Excellent taxidermy. All right, guys. All right, guys. Till next week.
Peace.
Yes. Peace. Bye-bye.
Chapo out.